This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
One of the amazing things about the Bernie Sanders campaign was that the campaign took on all of the issues at once. It wasn't a single issue campaign. And the people who were involved in the campaign recognized that climate is not a wilderness issue. It's not really an environmental issue. It's a human rights issue that affects everyone, not just people who might say their top issue is the environment. And first and foremost among that is young people.
All over the world, people who care about the environment are watching the U.S. president-elect sketch out a blueprint for disaster. To head the EPA, he's tapped a man who demonstrates open disdain for the very agency he'd be running. And for Department of Energy chief, his choice is a guy who announced on a national stage that that department should be dismantled. It's no wonder climate scientists around the country are scrambling to back up their research data, fearing it might vanish in the years ahead. Signs point to an incoming administration that will undo hard-fought progress on all environmental fronts. But this week on Sea Change Radio, we talk to two political organizers who've written a roadmap for how we fight back. We hear from Becky Bond and Zach Exley, two senior advisors from the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign, and authors of the new book, Rules for Revolutionaries. We discuss Sanders' dark horse candidacy, extract lessons learned, and talk about strategies that could be applied to the environmental struggle moving forward. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Becky Bond and Zach Exley. They both are former senior advisors for the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign. Zach, Becky, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Oh, thanks for having us on, Alex.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
I should also mention you are authors. Your new book is Rules for Revolutionaries, How Big Organizing Can Change Everything. So Zach, you started very early with the Sanders campaign. Bernie Sanders was somebody that a lot of progressives really liked what he was saying. His policies made a lot of sense, but he was not somebody who was coming on Meet the Press. He was more on Democracy Now. What did you see in this candidate that made you think we can do something here with an older Jewish man from Vermont?
A socialist.
A self-proclaimed socialist, 74-year-old Vermontan with a strong Brooklyn accent. How was he going to like rock the presidential election of 2016?
Yeah, I mean, there's been this amazing new thing that's happened over the last 15 years where, you know, in America, we've always had these insurgent presidential campaigns. You know, it's one of the great things about our system where people can come out of nowhere and say, I'm going to run for president. And you know, we've had a long history over hundreds of years of, you know, some really amazing great people and some really bad people running and, you know, gaining a lot of momentum, but never being able to come anywhere near, you know, actually winning, right? So the internet changed all that. And it's not some kind of like magic tech thing that changed it. It's just that, you know, the way the world changed with the internet, it gave regular people the ability to gather resources in a way that previously was only available to the very rich and to, you know, big industry people. And so it was really fascinating that in 2000, you know, in that election, Karl Rove created this fundraising machine where they went around to every CEO and every big trader on Wall Street, and they got them to become fundraisers for the campaign and to max out for George W. Bush. And they actually put tracking codes on the checks with the industry code, with like the actual like government code, you know, tracking code for their industry and sub-industry so that they could tally it all up and figure out who to give favors to. Believe it or not, if this sounds weird, it's actually all true. And the Democrats didn't have anything that could compete with that. And then Howard Dean, it wasn't actually something that the Dean campaign, you know, thought up in advance. It was when Dean announced, you know, it was the same kind of thing. It was this guy from Vermont that nobody had ever heard of. And but he was saying, why the hell did we go to war in Iraq? This is so dumb. In fact, I think he announced before we went to war in Iraq, and he was opposing the war and saying, this is ridiculous. What is going on here? And he had a lot of other progressive positions that most Democratic politicians were afraid to go anywhere near. And he just was sort of being himself and just running. And it was such a shock, and people were so excited about it. And again, this had happened before, but with the internet, people were able to start rallying huge resources. So he went on to raise way more than the big money candidates, John Edwards and John Kerry. He blew them away and became the front runner because the media, you know, dutifully reports whoever has the most money as the front runner. So that kind of that same internet mechanism allowed Democrats to compete in a whole new way. And so when Bernie announced, you know, I'm going to skip over the Kerry stuff and the Obama stuff, but let's get to your question about Sanders. So when Sanders announced, yeah, it's like some of us knew that even though he was somebody who the mainstream media was not going to take seriously, we knew that the American people were so angry and so fed up with 40 years of declining income and, you know, massive displacements of tens of millions of people losing their homes in the financial crisis where we bailed out bankers instead of homeowners, bailed out Wall Street instead of Main Street. People were so angry that some of us who knew Bernie, like Becky and I and a bunch of other people, we knew that when his message got out there, and we knew that it would over social media and over the internet, that people were going to donate and they were going to sign up to volunteer and go to work.
Becky, why don't you explain a little bit your background and what you created in the political division of Credo Mobile? Zach was just speaking about how Karl Rove was kind of a pioneer in getting political money from corporations, and Credo Mobile was on the flip side, on a progressive side of things, a company, but one that wore its politics on its sleeve. And you were kind of at the nexus of organizing in the corporate and election worlds. Why don't you explain first for our listeners what Credo Mobile is and what lessons you learned from it that you applied to the Sanders campaign? Also, as a disclaimer, I should mention to our listeners that I did consulting work for Becky at Credo Mobile. So
for 15 years, I worked at Credo Mobile, and Credo Mobile is an amazing funding mechanism for the progressive movement. That's basically the exact opposite of the kind of fundraising that Karl Rove and the right wing does. So instead of having corporate giving be decided by a bunch of usually older white guys in a corporate boardroom deciding how to use money from the company to do things like the Koch brothers do, and keep Republicans in power. What Credo does is it runs a really good mobile telephone company, and part of the gross revenue from the phone bills of its customers goes to progressive nonprofits. So for example, Credo Mobile is the biggest corporate contributor to Planned Parenthood. And it's only because it's the customers who decide where the money goes and want to see it support progressive causes, as opposed to the people who are profiting from a big corporation deciding how to use the power of the company to support right-wing causes and politicians. So one of the things that I learned during my career at Credo is that, you know, people, they want to do more than just write a check of a small amount every month. And if you're leaving your donors on the table and not engaging them in a broader sense of your campaign, you're really missing out. And at Credo, we didn't just ask our customers to pay their phone bill every month and then use that money to support progressive nonprofits. We always got our customers involved in the activism, had them make phone calls, had them send letters to decision makers. We had them show up at meetings with the state staff of their senator and their member of Congress. We even helped some of them get arrested protesting the Keystone XL pipeline. So I knew that there was a great capacity in the grassroots where supporters are willing to do much more than campaigns normally ask them to do. And as a company, we also had the ability in 2012, in responding to the resurgence of the of conservatives with the Tea Party movement, actually started a super PAC called Credo Super PAC. And at Credo Super PAC, it gave me the opportunity to test out some of the ideas that we were able to use in the distributed organizing on the Bernie campaign, but make them much, much bigger, because instead of going after Tea Party Republican members of Congress, we were trying to win the whole thing by winning the Democratic nomination for the presidency. At the heart of all this is this really interesting inversion of the way things normally go. You know, with Karl Rove and the right wing, a lot of how they organize the money is person by person with really big checks and really powerful one percenters. But we didn't have a few very, very wealthy individuals who were willing to give a lot of money in order to influence the outcome of election. But what we did have was we had access to millions of people who were willing to do a little bit of work, and maybe some of them a lot of work, or give a little bit of money. And the challenge was to get them organized. And so as someone who came out of the digital realm, someone who got involved in organizing as a digital person, I realized that we could actually use the internet and digital tools in order to organize these folks and make them truly more than the sum of their parts and as a fighting force for change. But it involved not only having them take action online, but it had to do with organizing them online to do things in person. And I think that's where the real power of the distributed organizing on the Bernie Sanders campaign came, which is that we were able to use, and mostly consumer technology platforms like Google Apps and Slack and Trello and other things, we were able to use consumer technology to get millions of people organized across the country to do actual real work in person together that could help implement a giant national field effort and try and put Bernie Sanders over the top.
What would you think if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. I try not to sing out of key. I get by with a help from my friend.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Zach Exley and Becky Bond. They're former senior advisors from the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign, and their new book is called Rules for Revolutionaries. So a year ago, when you guys both started working together on the Sanders campaign, what did you envision? Did you think you'd be writing books on the template for the future of democratic organizing? Or did you think you were going to be helping President-elect Bernie Sanders pick out cabinet members?
One thing Becky and I really have in common, I think, is the way we approach campaigns, where we just really get into the mindset of winning. And it sort of doesn't matter. And then, you know, all calculations just go into how do we win. And I don't know, you know, I've seen people on presidential campaigns before start like binge watching The West Wing when they think they're going to win, you know, and that's a bad mentality to get into. So
that's right. We were totally trying to win. That's what we were trying to do. We were trying to win because we saw that Bernie Sanders had a chance because of all the people that were getting involved all across the country. We thought, wow, if all those people could actually do work that would contribute to the field plan of the campaign, he could actually win. And that's what we thought about every day, was how to harness that grassroots energy and put it behind the campaign so that Bernie could win it. And we didn't think any further than the next election day.
Yeah, and that's the great thing about presidential campaigns, is it kind of gives you, it's the one place, right, where in approaching organizing, but also approaching any part of the campaign, where the stakes are so high, And victory is so binary, you know, there's no like way to get there, way to get halfway there, you know, and just make some gains in a compromise. And so you get to just go for broke, right? And that's what makes it so much fun, and also what allows so much innovation to happen on a presidential campaign. There's some young people out there listening to this show who are going to work on a really important presidential campaign in the future. And so they should hear this, that, you know, the Bernie campaign was not like all about, you know, taking risks and, you know, empowering every staffer in every department to take big risks. You know, often it was quite the contrary. But that's true of every campaign. That's true of every organization. You know, your boss is always going to be a little risk averse. But if you really have a vision for, you know, winning, and if you see some innovations that really need to be done, you just have to go for it. And that's what I mean by the high stakes of the presidential campaign. If you choose to, you know, if you really accept your mission, as somebody who needs to break through barriers and innovate on a presidential campaign, which is, I think that's the duty of every staffer on a, you know, progressive insurgent, presidential campaign, you know, then you just need to go for it. And so we did all kinds of crazy stuff in order to, give our department even a chance of existing. And, you know, it definitely was not just built into the situation, but I think that's why, you know, Becky and I both kind of have the same attitude towards that. And that's what I was getting at before, that I think I actually don't think we would have gotten very far at all if Becky hadn't joined. And I don't know if Becky had come first. Maybe she would have needed me too. But having the two of us both really have this same attitude of just like, let's do whatever it takes to make this happen, even when, you know, our bosses, and sometimes even when volunteers or colleagues don't understand it and don't support it, let's just go for it and take a risk and show that this will work. I think that's a really important thing. And there were a lot of departments in the Bernie campaign that had the exact same attitude. You know, our advanced department operated like that, and they were the ones that pulled off those amazing, huge stadium rallies. You know, that a campaign as small and weird as ours in the beginning, you know, had no right to be able to pull off. Our field leaders in Iowa and New Hampshire brought the exact same attitude of just go for broke, we will win no matter what. And, you know, and of course, thousands and thousands of volunteers who were leading their local groups and doing all kinds of amazing stuff brought the exact same attitude.
I think it's the only advantages that we had, that you can say that we had on the Bernie campaign over the Clinton campaign, was really the message, Bernie's message. That was our best asset. And then number two, Bernie as a messenger. He was an amazing messenger that people trusted. But other than that, we had deficiencies that turned out to be opportunities.
Which are the ones that come to mind, those deficiencies?
So for example, in the beginning, you know, we didn't have a big digital staff that could go and do organizing. And so in the beginning, it was just Zach Exley and Claire Sandberg, who were tasked with responding to the hundreds of thousands of volunteers across the country who were clamoring to get involved and who didn't have field offices open in their states. So that was in the beginning, in the summer, that was 46 states. And so the opportunity that, you know, that they had was to start deputizing volunteers to do valuable work as leaders in their communities and start putting together a campaign operation in states that would take months for the campaign ever to send paid staff and put an on-the-ground organization there. And it was through that we were able to build this incredibly huge voter contact machine that was centralized with a lot of consumer software that allowed us to do more voter contacts in a primary than any other presidential primary had before us. It was truly an unprecedented effort.
Yeah, I'd say one other example of that was outside of our area, but in the digital operation and specifically the digital fundraising team. For a long time, we just had two people and then three people run basically doing all the work in our digital fundraising operation. And, you know, eventually there were a few more, but for so long, it was just these three. And and meanwhile, on the Clinton side, they had this huge team, and of course also a lot of senior people that were kind of involved in the messaging. And we know all this now because of the WikiLeaks emails, you know, that kind of show people agonizing over, you know, little wording decisions and stuff like that. So we had this very lean team that took that same exact attitude, you know, the same exact approach of we just have to do whatever it takes to succeed. And so they were able to have this really powerful messaging stream in the emails that they sent out to our millions of supporters. And it was incredibly effective.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm speaking to Becky Bond and Zach Exley. They're former senior advisors from the Bernie Sanders campaign. And their latest book is Roadmap for Revolutionaries. So let's apply some of the lessons that you learned in terms of grassroots campaigning from the Bernie Sanders campaign. How can we apply that to environmental activism over the next 4 years? I know we saw Bill McKibben and others, including Becky, involved in trying to fight the Keystone XL pipeline, but that was with a rational administration in place. How does one begin to make waves and a positive impact in fighting for what they believe in terms of clean air and water over the next 4 years, dealing with these somewhat irrational actors?
Well, I think that's actually already happening. And one of the amazing things about the Bernie Sanders campaign was that the campaign took on all of the issues at once. It wasn't a single issue campaign. And the people who were involved in the campaign recognized that climate is not a wilderness issue. It's not really an environmental issue. It's a human rights issue that affects everyone, not just people who might say their top issue is the environment. And first and foremost among that is young people. And around the country, young people went for Bernie. They volunteered and voted for Bernie in huge numbers. And they cared. A lot of people in the media tried to suggest that these young people just wanted to get free stuff because Bernie was talking about free public college tuition. But when you went on college campuses or you talked to young people, you know, they would say that their number one issue was addressing the climate crisis. Their number two issue was usually addressing racial justice. Number three was probably money in politics, and number four was free college tuition. And because they were some of our most amazing volunteers adopting some of our tactics, like using Slack groups and Facebook groups for volunteers to coordinate management of activities together, they're still working with some of the playbook that we used on the campaign, and they're deeply involved in climate issues. And I'll give you one example, is that actually after the primary, a lot of the college students for Bernie volunteers and a lot of the millennial Bernie staffers who've been part of the distributed organizing program, they actually went and worked on turning out students on campuses to vote, you know, against Trump in the election, using peer-to-peer text messaging, using conference calls, using canvassing on campus. And I think we're going to see a lot of the techniques and the software and a lot of the groups of volunteers that worked together on the Bernie campaign, a lot of them went to show solidarity at Standing Rock and the Dakota Access Pipeline fight. And many of them are going to work to try and keep fossil fuels in the ground, but with a renewed sense that that volunteers can be the leaders and that they don't have to wait for paid staff in Washington, D.C. to come help give them an opportunity to do something big. So I think we're going to see a lot of amazing stuff happening with a lot of the young leaders coming out of the Bernie movement, taking the lead, inspired by the Standing Rock Dakota Access Pipeline victory, and literally going after every infrastructure project, every export terminal, to try and keep it in the ground while Donald Trump is president.
Well, that's the key, is while Donald Trump is president. We haven't seen any activism under his administration yet because it hasn't begun, but do you think it'll be harder or easier to activate people when they have somebody at the top who doesn't believe in some fundamental truths like climate change?
What I find hard to understand is why President Obama, you know, who I saw speak in person in 2006, and he said, to fight climate change, we need a economic mobilization on the scale of World War II, which that was spending half of our GDP to completely build a new economy for several years, right? And he said, that's what we need, guys. That's what we need to do. This was before he was running for president. And then when he becomes president and he's got a Democratic Congress, when he became president, and yet he did not go to the people. If I think Obama's the irrational one, actually, because Trump is behaving very rationally. He's got investments in these pipelines and in these oil companies, and all of his friends do. So they're behaving very rationally when they oppose, doing anything against to change the economy around the environment. If only Obama had followed some, big organizing practices and had gone to the American people, like Trump is doing now for his agenda. And if, whereas Trump's agenda appeal, of deporting 11 million people and whatnot, appeals to a small fringe, those are the folks that really get excited about his agenda. But just imagine if Obama had gone to the people and said, hey, not only are we going to create 100 million amazing jobs by, spending the next several years totally rebooting our economy, but we're also going to transform our energy economy so that we've got basically no carbon emissions and have a really clean, green economy. People would have gotten so fired up about that.
Yeah, exactly. The second Van Jones got thrown overboard for having socialist leanings, that could have been a big red flag there, no pun intended. And that this was the green jobs evangelist for the Obama administration. He should have been elevated within that administration, not thrown aside.
Well, I think that's right, but I'm gonna sort of disagree with just even comparing President Obama to President Trump when it comes to climate, and I wanna say that there is a lot that that people who wanna protect the climate can do even during a Trump administration, and part of that is building on the success of being able to block and slow down the Keystone XL pipeline and also the Dakota Access Pipeline, is that, the demand for drilling more fossil fuels, that's going to depend on being able to export this stuff. And so the extent to which states and local PUCs control export facilities, the extent to which activists who are blocking pipelines every inch of the way as they're built can make it more expensive and make it take more time to put this infrastructure in place. There is a role for individuals, especially individuals working together in their communities where this infrastructure is going in, to slow down or stop any progress towards taking more fossil fuels out of the ground that the Trump administration will be able to accomplish. So I think it's a dark time, obviously, and there was a bigger gap between, even though I wasn't happy with Clinton's environmental agenda, there was a bigger gap between Trump and Clinton than any two nominees for president, in my lifetime. But there's still things that activists can do. In addition to that is, trying to elect a new Congress in 2018 and a new president in 2020 so that we can get back to what Zach is saying, which is the need to have a comprehensive plan to rebuild our economy and make a sustainable energy future, not just a little bit around the edges, but let's get to 100% sustainable energy in this country. That could be part of the agenda, but not until we replace our leaders.
Becky Bond and Zach Exley, thanks so much for being my guests on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
Thanks. Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Lettuce and Widespread Panic. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.